And we're looking at an ancient story as told in the first few chapters of the book of Genesis. Genesis 1 through 11 actually is the focus of where we're going over the next few weeks. We've looked at in the beginning was God. Pretty simple. In the beginning was God. Last week we looked at in the beginning was creation. And this morning we're going to look at in the beginning was a couple. But before we get started, I wanted to, as we're looking at an ancient story and asking the question, how can an ancient story have an impact on the lives that we are living now? There's one word that just comes to mind, and it's faith. I read one of the verses that I've really been thinking about over the past few weeks is found in the book of Hebrews. And I wanted to share this with you because as we look at an ancient people back in the early days of Genesis, one of the things that this ancient community was commended for was their faith. And this is Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 through 3. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. I want you to listen. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what is visible. I don't know about you, but I long to have a faith that would be commended. That God would look at my faith and it would be commended. And if you, like that, would like to have a faith that would be commended by God, might I suggest it begins with having a faith in God who is the Creator. Isn't that great? By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. This is what the ancients were commended for. Who is this God? Who is this God that we have been talking about over the past couple weeks? Who is this God that we are invited to place our faith in Him, our trust, our hope in Him? He is eternal, meaning He has no beginning and He has no end. He is sovereign. He is supreme. He has no equal. I've said this over the past 2 weeks. I'm going to say it again over the next 12 weeks. There is no God who is like our God. He has absolutely no equal. There's no one that we can compare our God to. Through spoken word, the heavens and the earth came to be. Consider, through His spoken word, He speaks and things come into existence. By the power of His word, He's able to create something out of nothing. By His spoken word, life is formed. That's the power of our God's voice, His spoken word. And this is the God that we are invited to put our trust in. Is there anyone else who is like our God? I mean, think about that for a minute. Is there anyone else who is like that? Who's eternal, who's sovereign, who is supreme? At a spoken word, life comes forth. If you're here today and you're wrestling with some questions and you're asking yourself, who is this God? And you're trying to come to some conclusions of who God is, might I just invite you to consider this life-changing, life-transforming truth. There's no God like our God. There is no God like our Creator God. I love how God puts this question to Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 40. To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal? Says the Holy One. What a great question that God puts before Isaiah. To whom can you even possibly compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all of these? Who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name? Because of His great power and His mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Isn't that a great question? To whom can you compare? Who is my equal? Sometimes we don't think about this because the next verse says, lift your eyes. Often we can just see what's in front of us. Our eyes so quickly and so easily get distracted. And if you are here this morning and you are wrestling with questions of who is this God? And is it really possible that I can be in relationship with him? Rather than looking around, might I suggest you take Isaiah's word. Lift your eyes up. Lift your eyes up to the Creator. And you will come to realize there is no one who is like our God. There is no one who is like our Creator. Well, today we are going to continue with the creation narrative. Last Sunday we looked at day 1 through day 6 and a half. We're going to complete day 6 this morning. And really we're going to focus on looking at the creation of man, the creation of humanity. Very specific directions that was given to man. And then we're going to look at something pretty important, something that actually did not happen on the seventh day. If you would, just pray with me as we go there. God, we really need you to speak. We really need you to speak to us this morning through your word. God, might we not look around or look behind or look ahead, but might we look up, might we lift our eyes up to you and see that there is no one who is like you. You have no equal. God, we've come to learn and to realize that at your spoken word is creation, at your spoken word is life. God, might you speak to us, speak to our hearts, speak to our minds, speak to the situations that we find ourselves in this day. Speak to those, God, who are asking questions about who you are. Speak to those, God, whose faith is growing tired. God, through your spoken word, might you meet us in this place. Bring encouragement, bring conviction, bring transformation. God, we choose to place our faith in you because you can do these things and so much more. God, speak. We as a community are listening to what you would have to say to us this morning. If you have a Bible, go to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Now, if you remember where we left off last week, God had created all of the land creatures. And he sees that it's good at the end of verse 25. And then at the very beginning of verse 26, it says this. This is chapter 1, verse 26 in the book of Genesis. Then God said, every day begins with God speaking, with God saying something. And so we're called, encouraged. What is it that God speaks? What is it that God says? Verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. All right, now we have to stop, because it's now it gets confusing here. We get introduced to something we haven't seen yet before. God said, let us, in our image, after our likeness. The use of plurals here is introduced, has not been introduced before prior to the 6 days. So now we have to ask the question, what on earth is happening here that we have switched, that Moses now is speaking of God in plural form? Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Well, if you read a lot, there's like 50 different options of what the use of plurals here could be. And because I knew you were curious to know what all 50 options are, I'm going to give them to you. I'm just kidding. I'll just give you three. Three possible options of what this could be is God is consulting with the angels and the heavenly court. Now, I would say that's not a great option because there's not much precedence where God consults with angels before he is about to do something, seeking wisdom and counsel. So I'll scratch that option out as not a real strong possibility. Maybe this is just a grammatical construction, much like Queen Elizabeth when she speaks of herself in the we. It's kind of funny when she speaks of herself in the we, but maybe this is something very similar happening, that it's divine honor or majesty, much like royalty. Again, not a great option because there's not much precedence in the rest of scriptures where God speaks to himself in a royal sense where it's like a Queen Elizabeth type of thing. So a third possible option, and this is what most people would agree with, is that there's a divine dialogue within the plurality of the Godhead. And most would suggest that Moses is laying the foundation here for a triune God. Now, before you jump to this verse and say, see, this is proof text that there is the Trinity, and it's right here in Genesis 1:26. You have to understand that Moses would have no comprehension of a triune God. Certainly a plurality within the Godhead, because in Genesis 1 we see God. In Genesis 1:2 and 3 we see the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of God, hovering over the waters. So in seeking to understand the use of plurals here, the best interpretation, let me just give a word of caution. And this is just good Bible study here. Okay, when you're seeking to understand or interpret Scripture, you can't approach the text with the question, well, which interpretation best fits my belief? Does that make sense? We often go and say, well, I believe this about this, so that means this text has to fit my belief system. Meaning we believe in a triune God, that there is Father, that there is Son, and there is Holy Spirit, the Trinity. And so because we believe in Trinity, so we see in this text here, well, the use of plurals, therefore it must mean there is a triune God. You have to ask, what was the author, what was Moses communicating to the people, and how would his original audience have understood this? Okay, so you can't go and say, well, I need to find support and textual evidence for the Trinity. So therefore, Genesis 1:26 has to speak to that. So, I believe the use of plurals here is really best understood in the sense that, yes, there is a plurality within the Godhead, but we cannot derive a case-closed textual evidence for the Trinity. Okay, so yes, a plurality within the Godhead, and if you jump to the New Testament, we see God in Genesis 1, we see the Spirit of God in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and then the New Testament makes very clear in John 1 and in Colossians 1 that Jesus is very present at creation. But they would not have had a concept of this triune God. We continue. And God said, let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. I like how Moses just couldn't come up with words to describe the really the animals that he didn't like, those creeping things that creeps on the earth. Verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Okay, I tried to emphasize this, but in verse 27, I think the author Moses is trying to communicate to us, folks, it was God who created man. Not here by chance, not some random accident. God created. He created man. He created him, male and female. He created them. And what's interesting, as we just look at these few verses here, is we learn something about humanity, in that we have been created in the image of God. Every person that is sitting here in this room, you are an image bearer of the living God. There's not one person who has not been created in his image. Whether you know him in a personal way as Father, or you don't know him, you are still created. Everyone was created in the image of God. You're an image bearer. I know we don't use that language when you introduce yourself and say, hi, I'm Michael, and, well, it's good to meet you. Who are you? Well, I'm an image bearer of God. I know we don't use that that line of thought or thinking, but if we start to really understand, what does it mean that you and I are image bearers of the living God? I would think that we actually might start to live our lives just a little bit differently when we realize, wow, God's image is within us, his imprint. We're his image bearers. So what does it mean? If you flip over just a few verses or a few chapters, Genesis 5, we get some understanding of what does it really mean that we are image bearers. Genesis 5, verse 1 says this, and this is the book of generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness, after his image, and he named him Seth. If you have kids, you're able to see yourself in your children, aren't you? I mean, I have a son, Tristan. He's 4 years old. And when I look at him, I'm like, wow, that's mini-me. I mean, it's amazing how much we bear the same image or the same resemblance, the same likeness. I mean, he was my first son, and so it was just so amazing when I'd look in his eyes and I'd look at pictures of myself when I was his age, and it was just so amazing to be like, wow, this is a little me. Now, what's interesting, actually, twice this week, someone didn't tell me, because usually someone would say, hey, you know, your son really looks like you. And twice this week, someone has told me, wow, you really look like your son. And I was like, huh, well, that's kind of backwards. And then someone actually told me, wow, you're kind of acting like your son now, too. We have this unspoken rule in our family that if someone travels and goes away on vacation, which I will not name the person in our family, Kyla, who went away last week, we have this rule that you're supposed to bring home a present for everyone. It doesn't have to be like a huge present. And so when this individual, Kyla, came home, she came home with gifts. And Tristan got a gift, Riley got a gift, and then Caden also got a gift. And then Kyla, I didn't mean to mention her name there again, got a gift as well. And so I'm kind of smiling, thinking, oh, the best is for last. What did you get me? Nothing. Nothing. I didn't get anything. And so I started to pout a little bit. And someone who was in the room watching all of this said, wow, you are acting. Not only does you look like Tristan, but you're actually acting like Tristan now. So anyways, that was a bit backwards. But if you have kids, you understand this concept of seeing ourselves in our children. But as the image grows more recognizable, not just in a physical likeness as our children grow up and mature, so it's not just in a physical manner, but in the way our child begins to mirror our attitudes or our expressions and the character traits that he sees or she sees in her mom or dad. So this is not just a physical thing, but our children begin to mimic or mirror what they have come to see or know in their parents. So when it says that we have been created in the image of God, that means we have been given the capacity to mirror divine attributes. The image of God in us provides you and I the ability and the capacity to act like God, not to be God. I want to make that clear, not to be gods. We're not small g's, okay? We're not little gods. But because his image is on us, and he created us in his image, he's given us the capacity to mirror what we know of him. Well, what's the first thing that we really learn? I shouldn't say the first thing, but what are the things that kind of jumps out in Genesis 1:1 that we learn about God? Is that God is creator, meaning he creates. And so when you and I are creating or creative, we are mimicking or we are mirroring an attribute of God. Now you might think to yourself, well, I'm not a creative person. I don't sing, I don't dance, I can't sculpt, I can't paint, I can't do anything that typically people say are creative. That's just not true. Because God's image is on you and in you, we have the ability to be creative people. Now again, you might just not, I'm not a creative person. I'm just kind of blah. I'm kind of bland. I don't really create anything. How many husbands, raise your hand if you're a husband. Okay? Put your hands down. As you're a husband, you can be creative in the way that you pursue and date your wife. Now, how many wives would like say amen to that? I wish my husband was more creative in the way he pursued me or dated me, right? They are, right? We've got one, yes. I just want you to know that we can be creative in our relationships with one another. We can be creative in the way we communicate. We can be creative in the way we spend our time. We can be creative in the ways that we serve. When I do marriage counseling with people, one of the things that I talk about is just being creative in the relationship. And one of the ways that I say is be creative in how you are generous. Often we're just kind of, we write our checks and we do our thing and that's it. Might you be creative in the way that you give? And every time we are being creative, we are mirroring an attribute of our God who is a creator. But it's not just being creative. I want you to consider that every time that you are faithful, every time you demonstrate faithfulness, you are reflecting the creator. Why? Because he is faithful. Every time you are merciful, you are reflecting your creator because he's merciful. Every time you are compassionate and kind and generous and loving, anytime you bless, anytime you do these things, you are reflecting your creator. Why? Because he's merciful, he is kind, he's generous, he is compassionate. Anytime you are loving, not just in words, but in deeds, you are reflecting your creator who is loving. Conversely, when you're angry, when you're bitter and jaded, or when you're just impure, selfish, self-centered, abusive, maybe physically or verbally, when you lie, when you distort truth, you're not reflecting the image of your God, of our God, of the Creator God. Rather, when we're living just blatantly in sin, we are only marring, distorting the image of God in us. And when we do that, it makes it very difficult for people to see God in us. When I am responding to people in anger and frustration or bitterness, or I'm just selfish, that is not who our Creator is. I'm not reflecting Him. I'm just being sinful. Just being sinful. Consider a few verses here. Leviticus 9:19, verse 2. It says this, "Be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy." Why does he call you to be holy? Because he is holy. And we are image bearers of God, called to be holy. I think, Jim, we have this in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 22 through 24 says, "You were taught with the regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness." How often we live our lives like used-to-bes. Our former way of life, before God grabbed hold of us. We live in former ways. We live, no other way to say it, but it's just used-to-bes. And Paul says, no, you've been made new in attitude of your mind and put on the new self. Why? Because you were created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. Paul goes on in Ephesians chapter 5, a very convicting verse here. Be imitators of God. Be imitators of God. Isn't that what our world desperately needs? People who claim to be in relationship with God to be imitators of God, to reflect his image in us in the way we live. As image bearers, we're called to reflect our Heavenly Father in every moment, in every situation, every day, in every space, in every place, in every conversation, in every reaction, no matter where you are, no matter what you are doing. Do not forget that you have been created in the image of God. I mean, that might cause us to slow down and question, wow, how have I been doing as an image bearer of God? sometimes our words just fly out, or our responses are just wrong, inappropriate. The things we allow our eyes to see, the places where we allow our minds to dwell. You are an image bearer of God, created in His image. How are you doing at being an image bearer of God? Reflecting your Heavenly Father in attributes. Please wrestle with that question. But let the answer transform. If, as an image bearer of God, be faithful, be pure, be holy, be righteous, be compassionate, be kind, be generous, be giving. Serve, love. That is what it means to live as an image bearer of God. Now, being created in the image of God also provides us with a basis for human dignity, as well as the sanctity of human life. And there's just tremendous freedom in knowing that we are image bearers of God. No matter what your background is, no matter your race, no matter your ethnicity, no matter your age, no matter whether you are alive or still in the womb, because you are an image bearer of God, you have tremendous value. Tremendous value as an image bearer of God. So before this week, you begin to look down on someone for something that they've done or something that they are not doing, would you remember that they too are also image bearers of God? And before you knock yourself, and how often we do this with the lie of, I'm just worthless. I've got no value. I'm really not that important. No one really cares about me, so I'm just, my life is pointless. I don't really have much value. I don't really have much worth. Would you please hear this? You are an image bearer of God. I can't say that enough. You are an image bearer of God. Your value and your worth is found in not what you do, or not the titles, or not your bank accounts, or in achievements, or accomplishments, or degrees. Your value and your worth as a human is based solely on the fact that you are an image bearer of God. And understanding this truth should not lead us only to view ourselves maybe differently, but others as well. We have all been created in the image of God, which means everyone deserves to be treated with the dignity that that image affords. Meaning, those who are sick, imprisoned, poverty-stricken, defenseless, widowed, orphaned, abandoned, abused. Might we come alongside those as fellow image bearers of God? And when we respond to others in godliness, we become clear reflections of the Creator. That's what it means to be an image bearer of God. Chapter 1, 26 and 27 make that very clear. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. One of the things that I want to caution you as you think about being an image bearer of God is three very quick things. A Christian understanding of the image of God must be separated from New Age thinking. New Age thinking would have us believe that we are gods. And let me be the first one to tell you, you are not gods. Neither am I. We are created in His image, in His likeness. We are not gods. Small g, big g, however you want to spell it. We are not gods. We are the created. He is the creator. The second thing is, when humanity, and we're going to get into this in the weeks to come, but when we rebelled against God, when we were disobedient, when we sinned, when humanity went its own way, we did not lose the capacity to be image bearers of God. It was marred, but not lost. Genesis 9:6, if you want to write down a reference, speaks to that, yes, we are still image bearers of God, but it is a marred, distorted image because of sin in our life. And this question, I don't know if you've been thinking this, but where it says, let us make man in our image after our likeness, let them have dominion. Verse 27, God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. Was Eve created right here? Was she like right next to Adam? Next week, we're going to get into this a little bit more, and so you got to come back next week to get the answer to if we actually see Eve created here on day six, or I'll plant this little seed. It's a good chance that there was at least 100 years that went by before Eve actually met Adam and was created, as told in Genesis chapter 2. So now you have to come back to find out what I mean by 100 years later. So we go on. Man is created, male and female in his image. Then God gives a blessing. Verse 28 says this, "And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And so every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food, and it was so." Okay? What does it mean that God created us in his image, but then he gives us a blessing here, starting at verse 27 into verse 30. We see two words, commands that humanity is given: to be fruitful, multiply, to fill the earth. We're at roughly about 6 billion people on this planet, so I'd say we're doing okay on that command of filling the earth. But what does it mean to have dominion over every living, breathing, everything that has life created? What does it mean to have dominion? And two words that are used are subdue or to rule. And God gives humanity the responsibility to take care of all that he created. Okay, so I mentioned this last week, but it's a big buzzword over the last few years of this idea of we need to be green. Okay, we need to be people who have a heart and a care and a concern for our environment. So one of the questions I want you to wrestle with is, what does it realistically mean to be green? Okay, because there's extremes, right? I mean, there are some serious extremes of how we can answer that question of how are we really to respond to being green or taking care of our environment. Now, I have to preface that the guy who is about to give you the answer to this question drives a Chevy Suburban 2500 three-quarter ton 454 7.4 liter 42-gallon tank car. Meaning, the vehicle I currently own and drive is probably, you know, responsible for about half of the depletion of the ozone layer. So, so keep that in mind, and also keep in mind that I did not actually start recycling until maybe about 6-7 months ago. And I only started recycling because someone in my family, who will remain nameless this time, said, you know, it'd be a good idea to start recycling. I'm like, really? It's just so inconvenient. I got to, like, separate my soda cans and my water bottles, and we got to cut up cardboard now, and then we got to put out, like, 10 different trash cans that have so many different, you know. It's like, that's just too much work. Can't we just throw it all in the garbage? And this individual said no. And so for the past 7 months, give or take a few days, the Davis family has started to recycle and things like that. So know that the guy answering this question of how green should we be is not very green. I'm not going to lie to you. And I'm not going to try and present an answer here like this is what I have been doing. But this is what I've been learning and how I will move forward. And I encourage you to think about this as well. What is a healthy or an appropriate view of ecology? How to take care of our environment? You know, it doesn't take much to see that our world is dirty. The air is full with smog, rivers polluted, toxic chemicals fill soil, oceans have become, in many ways, or many areas, garbage dumps, oil spills pollute our beaches, chemical rain. I mean, and if you ask Al Gore, he would tell you global warming will forever change our environment for generations to come. And many actually blame Christians for really the depletion of our environment, using verses in Genesis 1 as, well, you know, we have text proof that this world is ours and we can use it or abuse it as we want, no matter what the cost might be. And what I want to encourage you as an image bearer of God to consider is that it's really a mindset, is that you are a steward, not an owner. When you think about the environment, we are stewards of God's, what God has given to us in creation. We are not owners. God owns it. And I don't know if this is at all helpful, but at least helped me think. Over the years, Kyle and I have had a lot of folks who have stayed at our house and house sat while we were gone or while we were traveling. And sometimes when we would come back to our house was absolutely trashed. And we came back to our home and we were like, what's up with that? We asked you guys to stay in our house, you know, take care of it, make sure everything was, relatively speaking, well kept. And we would come back and it was almost as if there was no care, no concern for our home. I mean, it was just left in a mess. But then recently when Kyle and I traveled this summer, we had some folks stay at our place. And we came back to our house and there were some folks from the Genesis community who came over. And, I mean, they made our house over. I mean, it was better shape and condition than when we actually firstly bought it. I mean, they did things to our house that I didn't think were possible, and stains came out, and, you know, I mean, vacuuming of things I didn't know you were supposed to vacuum got vacuumed, and dust where I didn't know there was dust. You know, they, I mean, it was just amazing how they took such care and such concern for our home. We are stewards of this. We're stewards of our environment. We are not owners, but we have been commissioned and challenged and charged with taking care of what God has given us. What God has created for our benefit, our enjoyment, yes, but not at the cost of just neglecting or ignoring or abusing God's gift to us. So the question still remains, what does this, practically speaking, what does it look like? Should we all switch over to solar power for energy, or should we start investing in wind farms as an alternative source for energy? Should we become vegans? I hope I answer no to that question, but how much should we respond to taking care of our environment? Word of caution also is, as I mentioned earlier, man, there are extremes. And I got to tell you, sometimes it gets really frustrating to me personally when I meet people who care so much more about the environment than they do people. So there are extremes. And I know that there are places in our world where people are being impacted and affected because the environment is being neglected. I understand that and I realize that. I just want to caution that we are not called to worship creation. We're not called to call this place Mother Earth and worship Mother Earth. We are called to worship, commanded to worship our Creator God. So my answer is pretty simple in this. We do anything and everything that you possibly can, that we possibly can, to be responsible and resourceful. If that means recycling, then recycle. If that means being better stewards of water consumption, energy consumption, then do it. Part of this for me has been an education process of, Michael Davis, what does it actually look like for you to be a good steward or resourceful or responsible with the environment? Well, I'm making some changes in my life for the past 7 months. And I got to tell you, it was kind of a pain. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it was, I won't even get into all of it, but, you know, if that's something very small that I can do and just as simple as recycling, paper goods, canned goods, I mean, whatever it is, would you just go to God and ask, God, what does it look like for me to be a good steward of the environment, this place that you have allowed me to call home? What does it look like for you and for your family? What does it look like for this church community to be a good steward of the environment? That's my answer. Genesis 1:31 says this. We often look at the world and say, no, it's messed up, it's dirty, it's polluted, it's nasty, it's gross. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Not just good, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning the sixth day. What God has created is good. Let's continue to be good stewards of what God has created. We come to the very last day, the seventh day. We're on Saturday. By the way, sixth day was Friday. We're now at Saturday. We've arrived at the weekend. The seventh day begins in chapter 2, starting at verse 1. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all of his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all of his work that he had done in creation. Something amazing happened on the seventh day that had not yet happened. There was silence. There was silence. Now, for some of you, just me being quiet there for 10 seconds was like, what's he doing? When is he going to say something again? On the seventh day, there was silence. For 6 days, and God spoke, and God spoke, and God spoke, and God spoke, and said, let there be. But on the seventh day, there was silence. There was stillness. There was no activity. There was no noise. There was no speaking. All that God had willed and spoken into existence was now complete. And so God rested. I wonder if creation was like, wow, that's amazing. Day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6. What's going to happen on day 7? And there was nothing. There was just silence. And there was stillness. And I imagine there was just an incredible peace that came over creation on day number 7 as there was silence and stillness. How do we respond to day 7? How, as you and I, image bearers of God, how do we respond to a God who on the seventh day rested? He ceased from all of his work. There was stillness. There was no activity. There was no creating. There was no producing. There was just silence. How do we respond to a God who rested on the seventh day? Now, I'm not going to lie to you, it's a bit challenging to me, because if you were to ask me, well, Michael, what do you do on your seventh day? I'd tell you I work. I'm not speaking from one who has practiced a Sabbath well. And as I sit before you, I'm convicted beyond all conviction of, wow, you, Michael Davis, have not responded well to a God whose rhythm, whose pattern was 6 days he worked. 6 days he created, he prepared, he spoke. But on a seventh day, he was silent. He was silent. My pattern actually has been, I work as hard as I possibly can for days on end, sometimes for weeks on end. I pump my body full of as much caffeine as I possibly can, eat as many carbs as I possibly can, and I go and I go and I go, and then I try and go some more until I absolutely crash. And you know, after years of that model, I've actually started to realize, you know, that's actually really not probably the most healthy model or what God has even called, commanded, and invited me and you to live. I've been wondering, you know, how much more healthy mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally would I personally be if I followed the Creator's rhythm of working 6 days and resting on the seventh? I would venture to say, wow, life would look a whole lot different for me. I would venture to say it would look a whole lot different from you. So I've confessed to you my own shortcomings of not being a pastor who practices a Sabbath regularly. I don't want you to, I do practice Sabbath, but it's not a very consistent thing. My mode is go and go and go, and then when I get hit with a viral pneumonia that lands me in the hospital for a week, that's my Sabbath. Well, I don't think that's actually what God had in mind for Sabbath. And what I want us to understand just as we finish is some of us might think that Sabbath, a day of rest, this whole concept is just very foreign, it's very outdated, it's certainly not very culturally encouraged. We're encouraged to go and go and go and keep going, to produce very robotic lifestyles. But I have to say that those who do not practice a Sabbath regularly, we're missing out on a gift from God. It's that simple. God has given us a gift and a day of rest. And if we're not taking that, practicing that, being faithful to it, we're missing out on a gift that God has given us in a day of rest, a Sabbath. So what do you do? That's the question, right? The question is always like, okay, I'm going to try practicing or taking a Sabbath. So what do I do on this day? Or sometimes the question is, what don't I do on this day? Let me answer that question first, and so you know that Sabbath is not a holiday, it's a holy day. It's a difference of when we Sabbath, it's not like, well, we just sleep in as late as we possibly can, and then, you know, we just go shopping because there's great sales on the weekend, and then we just watch endless amounts of football, and that's our Sabbath. Okay, Sabbath is not a holiday from life, it's set apart as a holy day. On the seventh day, there was a declaration that it wasn't good, but that it was holy. So the model that God, he worked for 6 days, and then he rested. Okay, what would it look like for you to rest? To not produce, to not create, to not live like you have done the past previous 6 days. That's what it means when it says this day has been set apart as holy. Meaning there is one day in your week that should look very different than the previous six. I can't sit up here and tell you, well, for you it has to be this, and you can't do this, and you should do this. And I can tell you this, though. Sabbath is a whole lot less about doing, and it's more about being. Being with your Creator. So as you think about and pray about and contemplate, God, what would it look like for me to practice a Sabbath? What would it look like for me to stop creating and producing? What would it look like for me to rest? I believe God will give you some insights on that. But I can just tell you this, it should look a whole lot different than what you currently do your previous 6 days. I don't need a Sabbath. I work 7 days a week because I'm an important person. And I don't have time to take Sabbath. Ever have that mentality? I don't have time in my week to take a Sabbath. Well, that mentality is wrong. And really, when people say, I'm too busy, I'm working, you know, I've got too much to do, it's really core code for, really, I'm an important person, and my identity is based on what I do, not on who I am as an image bearer of God. So if your mentality is, I don't have time to take a Sabbath, you need to ask God to convict you of that and challenge you that you are not that important. Neither am I. I am not that important where I can't take a day of rest, a day set aside to be holy, a day set aside where I worship, a day set aside where I just be, I rest, and I rest with my God. Isaiah 58, chapter 13, or verse 13 says this, "If you keep your feet from breaking the Sabbath and from doing as you please on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the Lord's holy day honorable, and if you honor it by not going your own way and not doing as you please or speaking idle words, then you will find your joy in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the heights of the land." Sabbath is joy. Sabbath is a gift. It's not a punishment. when the religious leaders of Jesus' day started to accuse Jesus of, man, what are you doing? You're working on the Sabbath. And Jesus said to them, you guys are missing the point. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. What Jesus is saying, the Sabbath is a gift to you. It is a gift from the Creator God. So if you have to be reminded or commanded or coerced into taking a Sabbath, you're just missing the point. You're just missing the point. So the question is, what do you do on Sabbath? Be creative. Be creative. What would it look like for you to express or reflect your love, your appreciation, or respect and awe for God? One day a week, what would it look like for you to express to your God, to Creator God, that you love Him, that you cherish Him, that you honor Him? What would it look like for you? We're going to take time to actually practice some of this right now, and a time just to be silent and to be still. In a few moments, if you hadn't noticed, this morning we will celebrate communion together. We will come to the table, and there's tables around the room this morning. But I just want to initiate a time of rest for you, a time of silence, a time just to be still, a time to reflect on who God is and what God has done, a time just to be quiet of heart, quiet of mind, and just rest. It's really hard to do, but I want to invite you just to take a few moments, a few minutes, just to be still. And as best you can, be as quiet as you can. Not trying to distract those in front of you, behind you, or to the side. Just to be still and to be quiet. I continue to rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works, as God did from his. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest, so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience as the ancients. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, he entered once for all into the holy place, not by means of blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. The blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, to purify our conscience from dead works, so that we might serve the living God. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. This morning we come to the table. And the night that Jesus was betrayed, the night before he went to the cross, he took the bread and said, "This is my body that has been broken for you. And every time that you do this in remembrance of me." Remembering who Christ is, remembering what Christ has done for us. That through Christ we are purified, through Christ we are forgiven. Through his work on the cross, we find the forgiveness for our sins. And when we do this, we remember at what a great cost the forgiveness of my sin, of your sin, came. In the same way, he also took the cup. And he said, "This is the blood of the new covenant that is being poured out for you." This morning, as you will go to the different table, I encourage, if
you're here with your family and you want to celebrate coming to the table around with family, to do that. If you're here by yourself, then just enjoy a time at the table where you can reflect, where you can remember and celebrate what God has done for us. If you're here with a small group. But we're going to do this in silence, in a spirit, in an attitude of just silence. If you're here today and you have not yet made a decision to get in relationship with God through His Son Jesus Christ, confessing that you have sinned, if you have fallen short of God's call, and not yet made a decision to just repent from sin, to turn from selfish, self-centered ways and turn to the living God, then let this time be a time for you to really reflect on God. Your Creator, you've done amazing things. You've made it possible for my sin to be forgiven. You can make that decision today. You can make that decision to say, wow, I've sinned, I've fallen short. Through Jesus, we find forgiveness of sins. We find redemption. We find salvation. Only through Jesus. Not through good works, so that no man should boast. Not through any other way, not through any other means. Through Christ and through Christ alone. So, as you go and celebrate communion this morning, celebrate it in the stillness and the quiet and the silence. But in your heart, you communicate to our God, Creator God, thank you. That through Christ, my sins have been forgiven. That I've been made new. I've been made new. Father, thank you. We want to celebrate this morning, and it seems odd to celebrate in silence. But Lord, I just pray that by your Spirit, you would move in our hearts, in our minds, in the quietness. That we as a community would remember what you've done. Your body broken for us, your blood shed, poured out for us. We choose to remember, we choose to celebrate, and we choose to say thank you. All has been prepared for you, and as you feel led, please, there's a table back to my left, in the back corner over there, and then one directly here, or you can come to the front. But all has been prepared. Come and remember and celebrate what God has done for us through Christ.